Now we both kinda like it. Now we both kinda know that if we're ever gonna make it, we just need to let go.
You're listening to the Crosscutting Concerns podcast. I'm your host, Matt Groves. Please visit the site at crosscuttingconcerns.com, where you can subscribe, browse the archives, contact me, read show notes, and leave a comment.
Today we celebrate the first glorious anniversary of the Information Purification Collectives. We have created, for the first time in all history, a garden of pure ideology, where each worker may bloom, secure from the pests, obeying contradictory reports. Purification, of course, is more powerful a weapon than any fleet or army on Earth. We are one people, with one will, one resolve, one cause. Our enemies shall talk themselves to death, and we will bury them with their own confusion. We shall prevail.
I'm recording this podcast on March 18th, 2017. My guest today is a former sysop of the IBM 360 Mod 40. He was the person who introduced me to computers and programming, was my first teacher and mentor. Kevin Groves, how are you doing?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to have you on the show today to talk about a movie. One, because you have interesting perspectives on movies. Two, you have an interesting perspective on this particular movie, Pirates of Silicon Valley, because you sort of lived through these events, you know, in a sense, more aware of them than I was. These events taking place in the late 70s and through the 80s and early 90s. This is a movie, if you're not familiar, came out in 1999 on the TNT cable network, so it's a made-for-TV movie. What do you remember about this movie? Why is it still? Why do you still enjoy watching it to this day?
Well, these were events happening when I was in college, and then later on in my professional life. You know, interest in computers, and this was the early development days of computers, and actually, I call them the computer wars. You had various different computer companies competing each other. There was the, you know, the Zenith with their Z80. There was Commodore. There was the Apple and various other offshoots of that, and all vying for market at that point in time for a very actually small clientele that even wanted a computer.
Right. So this movie is mainly focusing on Apple and Steve Jobs and Microsoft and Bill Gates. It's only an hour and a half movie or so, so they can't certainly include all the details from all the different computers that were trying to enter that marketplace at the time. Let's start by talking about the actors a little bit. So Steve Jobs was played in this movie by Noah Wyle. You may know him from the television show ER, if you remember that. He's also been in the Librarian franchise. How do you think he did portraying Steve Jobs?
Well, I never met Steve Jobs, but everybody that's been around since that period knows a little bit about him. He was excitable, forward-thinking, used people until he didn't need them anymore and tossed them away. I think they portrayed him pretty accurately in that respect.
Yeah, we're going to definitely talk about accuracy in this movie later on. Bill Gates was played by Anthony Michael Hall. He's famously part of the Brat Pack and been in a lot of John Hughes movies. None of these actors in this movie are what you call A-list. It's a cable TV movie, but they're definitely some very good character actors. You know, what did you think of Anthony Michael Hall's portrayal of Bill Gates?
Well, he played him as a geek. You know, what we call a geek now. Very intelligent, driven, and, you know, kind of came off as being not very smart, but in essence, there was a lot churning inside there. So, I think they, again, never having met Bill Gates, I think he portrayed him pretty accurately from what I could gather.
There's lots of talk about him sort of mimicking Bill Gates' mannerisms, you know, the way he would stand and the way he would adjust his glasses and things like that. So I think those details were very well done. A couple other players in this movie, we'll talk about Steve Ballmer first. He was played by John DiMaggio, who is actually a well-known voice actor these days. He was the voice of Bender in Futurama and Jake in Adventure Time. This is sort of before Futurama. He played Steve Ballmer. What do you think of his portrayal?
Well, Steve Ballmer was actually a pretty behind-the-scenes guy. He wasn't up front so much with Microsoft. But they used his character in this to narrate and fill in gaps, which I thought was pretty effective, especially when they're talking about the Xerox or the IBM first foray, in which when they took DOS to him, but they didn't really have DOS. And he filled in the gaps why they didn't have DOS and what they were doing. So I thought that was very good.
We think we have what you need.
That's a start.
Now, we know that IBM has set up this place to compete head-on with Apple, and that you're gearing up to come out with a personal computer that will wipe them out. So we can get you an operating system.
What kind of operating system?
It's called DOS.
This is amazing. Wait, not just amazing, it's historic. It should be taught in all the history books. I mean, hung and framed in the National Gallery or something. Because this is the instant of creation of one of the greatest fortunes in the history of the world. I mean, Bill Gates is the richest guy in the world because of what started in this room. You want to know what else? It wasn't exactly smoke and mirrors, but we didn't have anything.
Yeah, Ballmer and Wozniak were both narrators of this movie, and they definitely helped to fill in the gaps. Like I said, you can only do so much in an hour and a half movie. I think the way he was portrayed is sort of this wild party animal sort of guy. It sort of, jives with what we know about Ballmer being this really loud, boisterous guy when he was later the president of Microsoft and so on. Let's talk about Wozniak a little bit. The more I learn about Wozniak, the more I feel like this is sort of the proto-computer programmer. Like, he's the programmer, if you will. He was played in this movie by Joey Slotnick, who isn't really known for anything. He was just a frequent TV guest star. You know, what are your thoughts on Wozniak's portrayal?
I thought it was pretty accurate. I do know that that he and Steve Jobs had an interesting relationship. Again, Steve used him for his technical knowledge, but Woz was nowhere near a businessman. He just wanted to invent things and be left alone. And when he was drug into things like the stock issuance and what have you, when he went with their initial IPO, he wasn't comfortable in that area. And I thought they portrayed that pretty well, quite honestly. And that there was always tension between he and Steve Jobs.
You know, Steve, there's things you probably have to get past with me. But I'm telling you, there's things that I have to get past with you. I mean, people say stuff about you sometimes, and I don't listen to them because I know you. I mean, I excuse stuff because we're friends. Worth it. It is. It's worth it. It's worth it. It's worth it.
So the idea of two partners that are at odds with each other creating something great, that's not really, I mean, that's a trope you see a lot of movies and even in real life. You have two people that are able to work together despite their differences. But one of the scenes towards the end of the movie, they're at this fancy dinner party. Jobs goes through this transition of being long-haired and has a beard, and he eventually cuts his hair short, wears suits, shaves his beard off, while Wozniak is still, you know, the t-shirt wearing, bearded, nerdy guy. And they're at this fancy party, and they're talking about all the items on the menu, like this fish that they're serving. And Woz says this great line. He says, "I can't eat that stuff. Can't we go to Denny's?"
Yeah. Yeah. That was Woz for you. He was more down-to-earth, typical guy. That dinner was actually kind of the swan song for Jobs, because shortly after that, he was forced out by Scully and the others and out of Apple, mainly because he was driving the company into two different sections, the Mac section and the Apple IIe section, creating a lot of turmoil in the company, and that was not good. So that was kind of his swan song dinner, because within a month after that, he was gone.
Right, and he did eventually come back to Apple, and we can talk about that. So those are the four main actors. There are some other characters portrayed, like Kotke and so on, but they're not really featured prominently in this movie. So let's talk a little bit about the history part of this. And we start with Gates at Harvard. He's opening up a popular electronics magazine, which I'm actually at my father's house right now. I'm going to rummage around in the basement to see if he has this issue. I'm pretty sure he does. There is this machine called the Altair 8800, which was on the cover of that magazine. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was first real introduction of the computer worldwide. I mean, a lot of people did not know about that. And for people that were hobbyists or even professional electronics industry, it was fascinating because here was a functional computer that could sit on the desk as opposed to one that filled a room.
So Gates and Paul Allen, along with some help, I think probably from Ballmer in there too, they approached MITS, the company that made the Altair, and said, hey, your box needs software for it. And I think MITS knew this as well. And they said, we're going to create a version of BASIC for the Altair. Now, they don't have BASIC, and they don't have an Altair. But what they did was they created an Altair emulator. And this wasn't really covered in the movie, but an emulator that would run on a PDP-10, which is a big mainframe. So it's pretty amazing that they created an emulator first and then used that to develop BASIC to sell it to MITS.
Yeah, it was a stroke of genius. And it was a way for them to start funding the company. They were selling it. I think they were getting about $12 a copy as a royalty or something like that on that. So it was a way to get Microsoft somewhat off the ground and get some funding.
Right, and they left Harvard famously. He dropped out of college to start this company, and that's sort of a theme in the movie that he's in these roach motels, kind of regretting his decision to leave college and start this company in a dusty office in Albuquerque.
Well, it was a case, again, you had a product with a very limited market, and the Altair required, I believe you had punch tape for that to feed it and get some get data back out of it. I don't think it had a screen. I think it was all very mechanical. Who had those around their house? Nobody.
Okay, and then we see later, of course, we can talk about Apple a little bit, but eventually Gates goes to this computer fair, and I don't know if this was exactly true, but you have the MITS people on one side, and you have Apple people on the other side, and all the attendees are rushing towards the Apple side and ignoring MITS. And so it's at that point that Gates decides, well, hey, Apple's where the money is. Why don't we try to work with them?
Well, you had the Apple had a CRT.
Yep.
Yeah, you could see it in live action, what was going on. It was interactive with the user, and which the Altair wasn't very interactive with the user. And you didn't have to be a programming genius in order to really use it. It still had limitations. You didn't have much software for the thing. But again, it was new and interactive, and that made a big difference to the people who were interested in computers in those days.
And then finally, the last part of the history that's covered in this movie is they sort of approach IBM, Microsoft does, and say that, hey, we know you're going to create something to compete with Apple, and we think you're going to wipe Apple out. We'll give you software for your system. And of course, as I explained, the pivotal part of the movie, this is where Ballmer steps aside and narrates and says, this is the genius, that they license the operating system to IBM. Did Gates know at that time? Do you think he knew that there would be clones that he could license the operating system to? Or was he just sort of guessing and got lucky?
I don't think he knew. He just knew IBM was big, and if anybody was going to be in the computer industry, IBM would be in there early on. They already were. I think he was just looking for some place to generate some revenue to grow his company. Why not go to IBM?
Right, and just because of the way he did that deal, when clones started coming out, he's able to license the operating system to all those clone makers. So the hardware becomes a commodity, essentially. There's not a lot of money being made there. The software is where the money is being made.
Well, that was IBM's mistake. IBM thought the money was in the hardware,
right,
when in fact it was in the software. They were so much into selling huge multi-million-dollar computer systems that they couldn't see the fact that Fortran wasn't going to be used by the average person. They needed something that would be more user-friendly. They didn't see it. They just thought the money was in the computer, in the hardware.
Right, and cloning the IBM PCs wasn't very difficult. They made them with off-the-shelf parts for the most part. The only thing that was really special about them was the BIOS, which was pretty simple and easy to reverse engineer. Compaq famously did that, and others. And the operating system, which was not IBM's. It was licensed to them by Microsoft. So other makers could enter the market and compete with IBM, drive the price down, and really make a lot of money for Microsoft. So let's talk about Jobs a little bit. Some of the background that's not covered in this movie. Jobs worked for Atari before Apple. He also worked there with Wozniak. Wozniak created a version of Pong, and that's... And then, actually, it's funny, Jobs took the version of Pong to Atari, and Atari thought that Jobs had created it. It was actually Wozniak. So that's sort of a microcosm for the whole thing right there. So they hired Jobs. He was contracted to create a game called Breakout, and he was paid to create this game, but also to create this game in such a way to reduce the chip count, to make it cheaper for them to mass manufacture. And this is sort of a legendary story about Wozniak writing the code for this game in such an incredible way that when they tried to reproduce it, no one could figure out how to do it. And they ended up having to ship a version with more chips. So it was an incredible work of genius. They also do cover the blue box in this movie. They used to make free long-distance phone calls and Captain Crunch, and that stuff's all true. And the funds from all those things, the blue boxes especially, went to start the Apple Computer Company.
Well, that was the basis of the whole movie, is they were stealing technology from each other.
That's a good point.
That was stealing technology from AT&T in order to get free long-distance calls. So, and that was just the first thing that they pirated, so to speak.
And they didn't even do that entirely themselves. Like, Wozniak spent a lot of time on the blue box, of course, but it was Captain Crunch who discovered that you could use the whistle to make these calls.
Right.
So they sort of co-opted that. So it's definitely a theme of everyone stealing from everybody else in Silicon Valley.
We have to think of ourselves as artists. And it's like Picasso said, good artists copy, great artists steal.
Of course, all the details about the Apple II and the Lisa and the Mac are covered in this movie. One of the most important scenes involves the Xerox Corporation and the Palo Alto Research Center, the Park Center. So computer developers, computer programmers like myself are quite familiar with Park as being this amazing research center, kind of on par with Bell Labs in terms of innovation. But, of course, the scene in this movie is that the Xerox engineers at Park could not convince the Xerox leadership that this was worth, you know, bringing to a consumer market.
Well, funny thing, about that period in time, I actually worked with Xerox. And I wasn't an employee, I was a Xerox agent. Xerox had something like 350 vice presidents. They were a huge monsters company in Rochester, New York. Rochester Park, or Xerox Park today, is still a huge empty space alongside the Kodak building that's empty. And it was interesting that Xerox couldn't, again, they were into hardware. They were selling copiers. They were people putting black marks on white paper. They never thought about how they created those black marks on a white paper. And things like mice or a mouse was counter to the company. You know, they let it go. A lot of people think that Apple stole that. They didn't really steal that. They traded some stock for rights to get the mouse screen interface type thing. They got it cheap. Let's put it that way. They got it really cheap. It was interesting. Xerox regretted it later on, but it was too late.
Xerox actually did enter the IBM PC clone business, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they did. It was an Olivetti machine that Xerox rebranded. And it was the 8088, basically. But they brought it out with their version of a word processor and a spreadsheet, again, to make black marks on white paper. And they had some other systems out there that really never took off very well.
So people talk about the mouse at Xerox Park a lot, and that is an important piece of technology there. But the mouse by itself isn't really that great if you don't have software to go with it. And this is one of the major innovations in the Xerox Alto, I think, was not just the mouse, but the UI that goes along with it. So the mouse pointers, the iconography, the windows, the scrolling context menus, all those things, that's what makes the mouse useful. you know, I remember we had a mouse, a three-button mouse on our old DOS system, and just moving a cursor around a text screen doesn't really do anything for you until you have some useful UI software for it. The other thing lost in the shuffle that wasn't covered in the movie is Ethernet, also invented by the Xerox PARC people.
Yes.
Which, you know, allows ease of use connecting to a network. So, I mean, they didn't invent networks, but they invented Ethernet, which becomes very important later on when you have the rise of the Internet and the web.
Yes, matter of fact, visiting the Xerox offices, I was first shown Ethernet and did not know what it was, but they said it was a way of communicating between systems. That's about all I knew about it, and it was interesting. They had all these cables running every place and trying to figure out how to hide them.
So speaking of regret there's also a scene where Wozniak has to take the Apple One into Hewlett-Packard because he signed a contract with them and has to give them rights of first refusal, basically. And HP turned it down, probably for the similar reasons that Xerox did.
Well, computers weren't HP's thing. In those days, HP was mostly into test and measurement equipment and things like that. They weren't really into the computers per se. So what he took them, I think the movie actually portrays it, was something built in a garage, you know, wood case, very small screen, didn't look like much, looked like something a hobbyist would put together. So they let it go. That's their own fault. Again, I'm sure they looked back and said that was stupid, we could have owned it. But again, companies in those days were pretty fat with the upper level management. They couldn't see the forest for the trees.
Why would IBM want to make a deal with a bunch of bozos like us?
Because they're successful, Ballmer. You know, success is a menace. It fools smart people into thinking that they can't lose.
So later, HP did get into the IBM clone business again, kind of like Xerox, just trying to get a piece of that market share that was growing.
Who didn't?
Exactly, right? Epson was in there. I remember we had an Epson computer. Compaq, of course. Packard Bell, which was like a spin-off of Hewlett-Packard at some point.
Yeah, Olivetti was one as well. There was a lot of companies. They're all basically the same.
It's portrayed in this movie that it's sort of a straight line between the Xerox Alto, which Apple gets access to, and then from there we see that it's implied Windows, it sort of rips off Macintosh UI. I think the real story is a little more complicated than that, as Bill Gates alludes to. Like, not all, you know, every car has a steering wheel. It doesn't mean that people are claiming, oh, I invented the steering wheel. I'm the only one that can use it. There are other UI softwares out there, other GUI softwares that Bill Gates looked at and was influenced by.
There may be some similarities, Steve. Similarities.
Try theft.
One of them was by VisiCorp, which you may know for VisiCalc, the first killer spreadsheet software. But they had something called VisiOn, which was a graphical user interface. So Bill Gates looked at that. So the real story is a lot more complex than, you know, Windows ripped off Mac, Mac ripped off Xerox.
Well, you know, there's a famous line in there that, and I don't know if it was actually said, but it kind of brings it all together, is they both have this big brother called Xerox. And they, you know, they both use Xerox to get what they wanted out of it. They used other people too, but that was the one, I think, a defining change for both of them. Apple still needed Microsoft to write software to sell their machines because they didn't have the capability of doing that. So Microsoft took advantage of that and said, well, we can come up with our own OS system for these PCs that were coming from, in those days, Japan.
Right. I think they showed DEC in the movie.
NEC.
Or NEC, sorry. We see IBM PCs are cloned a lot. Why do you think that Apple wasn't cloned as much? I mean, there were some official and unofficial clones of Macintosh. Even to this day, you can only buy, you know, the Mac operating system on Mac hardware for the most part. Now, I could hypothetically buy a copy of Mac OS and put it on a regular PC and make a Hackintosh, is what they call it, but that's against the licensing terms. And So companies like Dell and Lenovo cannot do that. Why do you think in those early days that the Macintosh and the Apples weren't cloned more?
Well, there's probably, I think, first of all, they wanted to control it all. They wanted to control it from the beginning to the end. The other thing is, he didn't want anything that IBM had. If it was IBM, he wanted just the opposite.
Man, 50! We sold 50! IBM has got to be loading in their pants!
You know, Steve, I don't even think IBM knows who we are.
Good. This is guerrilla warfare. They're the enemy.
They are? I used to think maybe Steve was born obsessed with wiping out IBM.
And IBM was more of an open system. Again, it would operate on any of these PCs out there. He wanted to keep it away from that. He wanted to be so different than IBM that he went to the extreme and said, I'm just going to close the system off. You want to use it, fine. I got great stuff, but I'm not going to open up to the world.
Yeah, they definitely portray that in this movie, that IBM was this sort of big brother enemy of Jobs. And also that Jobs was really into the artistic, emotional aesthetics. And he wanted to design he famously designed the cases for these computers and designed them in such a way that, you know, they look nice and they're beautiful, right? But they're not, you know, the IBM PCs were sort of these ugly boxes, but they were extremely open and you could, you know, modify them and use off-the-shelf parts in them.
They were less expensive.
Also true, yeah.
When I went to buy my first PC, I went to the store. I can't remember who was selling Apple in the Columbus area. And it was twice as expensive as the Commodores or the Z80s or the other ones out there. And I said, I don't think I want to spend that much money. The guy opens up the top of it and says, look, there's nothing to it. And I remember saying, if I'm going to spend that much money, I want that thing full of stuff. I don't care if it works or not.
We're better than you are. We have better stuff.
You don't get it, Steve. That doesn't matter.
But yes, in controlling it, he did, but he created a cult following within that. And so some people were willing to pay that kind of money. But in the long run, the PC won out because it was so much less expensive. You could do so much more with it.
Let's talk about accuracy a little bit of this movie. Now, it's obviously dramatized and shortened, and some of the events are shown out of order and things like that. The people involved in this movie were all still alive when this movie was released, and Steve Jobs, to start with him, he didn't really comment on this movie very much. He said that he hated it. He hated the film and the screenplay. It doesn't mean he necessarily thought it was inaccurate. He just said he hated it. Now, there's a lot of portrayal about Steve Jobs and his tumultuous family life and relationships, so if that was portrayed accurately and I regretted those decisions, yeah, I would probably hate it too.
I think so. He really was rather a private person about things, you know, and they were right in the movie. He did deny his illegitimate daughter for many, many years, but eventually came around to accepting her. But, he didn't really want anybody to know what he was doing or anything about his life. So a movie like this kind of opened it up a little bit. I'm sure they got a lot of the data from former Apple employees and also Microsoft employees as well. But a lot of this was guess. We don't really know what happened to that meeting, at those meetings between them, for sure, between Jobs and Bill Gates. We don't know. We can only guess.
So there is a scene in here where it's a very uncomfortable job interview that Steve Jobs walks in on and really just sort of harasses and harangues this applicant, mainly because he's kind of a personification of IBM, right? He's got the pocket protector and he's got a suit and everything. Now, Jobs denies that interview actually happened, but there are some people out there who say that this is a true accounting of events, and it's even worse than what's portrayed in the movie. Jobs starts making turkey noises and just really going crazy on this guy.
Well, he was known to be difficult to work with. Again, his whole thing was use people until he used them up and then cast them aside. He did that with Woz, quite honestly. When he no longer needed Woz, he cast them aside. And eventually, what you sow, you shall reap, he got cast aside.
So without further ado, the rumors are true. Ladies and gentlemen, our new president, John Sculley.
Thank you. To tell you the truth, I was perfectly happy to be president of Pepsi-Cola until Steve Jobs came to recruit me and said, do you want to sell sugared water for the rest of your life, or do you want to make history?
A lot of people said he was really, really difficult to work with and was moody and treated people very badly.
You know, some people say this is a management style of Jobs, was to just sort of confront people in a dramatic way to try to get the best work out of them. But I think that is, you know, borders on abuse.
Well, it became not just challenging, it became a point of humiliating people into doing their job. And he lost a lot of good people. Apple lost a lot of good people because of that. And that's one of the things, one of the reasons he was forced out.
Switching over to Bill Gates, he has commented that the film is reasonably accurate, which doesn't portray Gates in the best of light, but it doesn't exactly demonize him either. It shows him as kind of this, he was a really reckless driver, and that's true. He got in a lot of trouble for that. It shows him as very awkward and nerdy and socially inept, and I think that's probably true. He's very much a nerd type of guy, but he said it's fairly accurate. Wozniak has made a lot of comments on this film. He says that it's a good example, the example of a good Hollywood dramatization of himself, Jobs, and the story of Apple. And he said that every one of those incidences occurred, and it occurred with the meaning that was shown. That's a pretty strong endorsement from Wozniak.
Well, I can believe that. He was, you know, again, this guy is, he is what you see. He's a genius, an inventor. You know, he didn't want to play those games. So I can believe that if he said they were accurate, that they were. Because he was there for that.
Steve has to stand up on that stage in Boston. Man, that was weird.
The era of competition between us is over. Thank you, Bill. Thank you for standing with us. The world's a better place because of it.
Microsoft is going to ruin Apple! You can't trust them!
I know. I realize that this news may be shocking to some of you.
Okay, so let's sum up here a little bit, and some questions here. You know, it's implied towards the end of the movie that Microsoft invested a lot of money in Apple, and they were Bill Gates was shown on stage, and it's sort of this urban legend that Microsoft saved Apple in the late 90s. You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, Apple had some failures. The Lisa was a failure. Actually, the Mac never took off the way they expected it to. They lost a lot of money, and he was eventually forced out of the company. Started Next, dumped a lot of his resources into Next Computer, with the whole idea that Apple would have to buy him eventually, and then he came back because of that. That part was never talked about. It was talked about in the movie Jobs, but it was never talked about in this movie, what happened after that. But Microsoft did come in and dump a lot of money into the company and kept them solvent at a time when they could have gone out of business. You know, the Newton had failed after Jobs left and some other things. And they needed to be resurrected. Microsoft had the money.
One detail that wasn't covered in the movie was that the money that Microsoft invested was actually part of a settlement of a lawsuit about software. And again, we go back to the theme of them, everybody stealing from everybody else. There was no ruling, it was just a settlement. And Microsoft doesn't own any Apple stock anymore, maybe a token share or something. But an Apple apologist might argue that Microsoft is just investing its money because they're sort of obligated to legally, and they're not saving Apple per se.
Well, that's true. It did give them an opportunity to virtually take control of the company that they had pirated the software from, but give them another conduit for their software and actually kind of take a competitor out of the game, in essence, on that.
You sure it's okay to let these Microsoft guys in here?
We have culture. They don't. No taste, no original thinking. But they can be useful to us.
We're in. We're doing work for Apple.
You're kidding me.
No, they're sending us three prototypes of the new computer we just saw. The Macintosh.
For God's sakes, there's a pirate flag flying above our heads. And he's giving us the crown jewel. I mean, who the hell's the pirate here?
The guy sees what he believes, not the other way around.
So let's talk a little bit about Apple today. Apple is, of course, an enormous company with huge cash reserves, and there's been some trepidation after Jobs died about Tim Cook taking over and the direction the company's going, but I don't see Apple anywhere near struggling today. And of course, we live in a world of mobile phones now, where I think just recently Android has passed Windows now for the highest share of operating systems. So in terms of desktops and laptops, probably Windows is still the top, but Android as an overall percentage is beating out Windows.
Let's face it, he had the iPod helped fund the iPhone. He found a niche and kind of really left computing, and he's more into entertainment and communications now. It's not really Apple really in the computing company anymore, in my opinion. But that was the way the market was going, and again, they had a cult following. Look, when a new Apple iPhone comes out the lines, just so they can get the latest and greatest version of it, even if it's just a minor change. I think that cult following is what's made the company so successful.
I'd say the iPhone's a little more than a cult. It certainly has a cult following, but it's definitely a lot more mainstream than the Macintosh ever was, for instance.
I agree with that. Yeah. The Mac was just another computer, quite honestly. But it was expensive, and you didn't get much. I mean, as far as there was no bulk to it, and they introduced some new technology, the 3.5-inch floppy drive. That was the first time you saw that, and some of the screen graphics and what have you, but it never really took off that well. If you can't appeal to the business commercial world out there, you're not going to do very well with a product. So, and it never appealed to the business world. That was where the PC was going.
You know, Steve History thinks IBM's the enemy.
Unfolds in front of us.
He doesn't get it. You guys are.
What are you talking about?
Copies of your Windows just started surfacing here. You took our stuff, Bill. You took our stuff, you fooled with it, and you called it your own.
So let's talk about the legacy of the two main characters in this movie. So Jobs' legacy right now is pretty much the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad, things like that, iTunes even. What do you think it will be in the long run? Is it still going to be those devices even long after they're gone? Is it going to be his ownership of investment in Pixar? Is that going to be his legacy, or is it going to be something else entirely?
I think, unfortunately he passed away. I think his legacy is pretty much fixed now. It's got to be more of somebody was forward thinking in marketing and what the market wanted in his later life. That's where his brilliance was. We know he wasn't a great engineer. He wasn't a great software or programmer. He was just kind of forward thinking and good at marketing. Once he figured out you can't be a hippie and market at the same time.
In his biography, just to close the book on Steve Jobs, he's quoted as saying, quote, "I wanted my kids to know me. I wasn't always there for them, and I wanted them to know why and to understand what I did." You know, there's some portrayal of him and his family in this movie, and I think there's definitely some regret there that he sort of eschewed his family and taking care of himself and his family personally in order to focus on business. And I think, that to me, that's what the Jobs legacy means.
Well, that's possible. I think it was a lot of regret in later life, especially as he was facing terminal cancer, that he looked back and said there's some things he could have done and should have done different. That, I think, is only human nature to do that. But I think if he could do it again, he wouldn't have done it any different.
Bill Gates' legacy right now is probably Windows, the software licensing stuff that he pioneered, or maybe in some people's mind it's the antitrust lawsuits and monopoly accusations. But he's still alive, so he can still make an impact and shape his legacy. The Bill Gates Foundation, I mean, he's no longer a major Microsoft guy, but he's spending a lot of time on his charity and trying to stamp out polio, malaria, and diseases like that. So that may ultimately be the Gates legacy in the long term, is his effect on world diseases.
it's highly likely. He harkens back to the characters at early 21st century or 20th century, like J.P. Morgan and Andrew Carnegie and what have you, that made a tremendous amount of money and later in life really did not know what to do with it, so they become philanthropists and start giving it away in order to make their legacy look better in the long run. And I think that's what he's trying to do. I think he has all good intentions with this, but it's basically to overcome some bad PR, quite honestly, at being one of the wealthiest men in the world and may have got it not exactly ethically.
So, I took a bunch of notes. Anything else that you wanted to cover or talk about that we haven't discussed so far?
Those guys, along with some others, changed the world as we know it, created stuff that nobody could have foreseen in the 50s or 60s or even, you know, the early 70s, that did in fact change the world and created a whole new industry and, you know, changed communications and the way we do things, just the way we interact nowadays, you know, through email so much and using, you know, having, you know, walk down the street and talk on your telephone. When I was young, that would have been unheard of, not even fathomable. They helped change that, so kudos to them.
Would you recommend watching this movie?
Oh, I think so. I think it's a good movie. I would suggest watch this movie and then watch Jobs. You know, Jobs focused just on Jobs in that movie, but you'll see some of the same things that are going on. The difference with Jobs is that movie went beyond this. This pretty much went up into the early 80s, where Jobs went right up into the 90s, and more focused on him than on the company. So yeah, I would watch that. And you're also, if you see Jobs, you'll learn about Next Computing that most people don't know anything about.
My guest today has been Kevin Groves. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, thank you.
This has been the Cross-Cutting Concerns podcast, produced and recorded by Matt Groves, 2017. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it on social media and leave a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you downloaded this podcast. For show notes, please go to crosscuttingconcerns.com. This episode is recorded under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. Hosting for this podcast was made possible in part by Microsoft. It was recorded and mixed with the help of Audacity, Skype, and Camtasia Recorder. The theme music is by The Dirty Truckers. You can buy the music on Amazon or iTunes. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on a future episode, please go to crosscuttingconcerns.com to submit your name and idea.